It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Troubles refers to a 30-year period of civil war in Northern Ireland, which began in the late 1960s. Armed groups on the nationalist side fought for political unity with the rest of Ireland, and armed groups on the unionist side fought for Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom. Many innocent people were caught in the crossfire, and by the 1990s, more than 3,500 people had been killed. Even before this, there had been a long history of animosity between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland after centuries of British rule. In 1994, the British and Irish governments negotiated a ceasefire between the armed groups, and peace talks began. The man who led those tense talks was United States Special Envoy for Northern Ireland, George Mitchell, a former U.S. senator from Maine who had served as Senate Majority Leader. Senator Mitchell has been named the inaugural recipient of the La Roche College Peace Medal in recognition of his work as independent chairman of the Northern Ireland Peace Talks and as U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace. The award will be presented tomorrow, and Senator Mitchell will also be the keynote speaker for the 8th Annual Global Problems, Global Solutions Conference. The session at the Duquesne Club that will include his remarks starts at 6 p.m. tomorrow night. He joins us by phone. Senator Mitchell, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
And if you have a comment or question for our guest, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address, essspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Senator Mitchell, I want to start by going back to how you got involved in the peace talks in Northern Ireland in the first place. You had left the Senate unexpectedly in 1995 and then declined a nomination to become a Supreme Court judge. So how did you end up being appointed U.S. Special Envoy for Northern Ireland?
When I told President Clinton of my intention not to seek re-election in 1994, he first tried to talk me out of it to stay, but I wouldn't do that. So he then asked me, are you just sick of politics, or if I think there's something you might be useful in, could I call on you? And I said, no, I'm not sick of politics. I really like it, and I like public service, and I'd be happy to do anything you think I might be able to do. They called me on a couple of occasions to do various things that didn't work out, but then he asked me to go to Northern Ireland. He said it would be for about 6 months. I was really just to organize a conference on trade and investment at the White House to encourage and support the ceasefires that had been declared in 1994 in Northern Ireland. Once I got there, I got deeply involved, and the British and Irish governments asked me to do several things, and I ended up spending 5 years there and chairing three separate sets of discussions, including the principal negotiations that led to the Good Friday Agreement.
In your book, Making Peace, you recalled walking into the conference chamber for your first encounter with the Reverend Ian Paisley, the fiery, militant Protestant leader in the conflict dividing Northern Ireland, and he objected to your chairmanship because he labeled you as, quote, a Catholic Irish American from the same stable as the Kennedys, end quote. What can you tell us about that first encounter with Reverend Paisley?
Well, in retrospect, it's humorous. At the time, it didn't seem it. After the two prime ministers of Britain and Ireland came to Northern Ireland to initiate the talks, it was on June 10th, 1996, they gave speeches and left, and then I thought I was going to go in and chair the proceedings. There were a lot of people there, two governments, 10 political parties, all represented. But there developed a very unpleasant and acrimonious debate among the political parties as to whether or not they would accept me as chairman. 7 of the 10 were for my doing it. 2 were adamantly opposed, including Dr. Paisley's, and 1 was undecided. The two governments, of course, had sponsored me, so they wanted me to do it. And it was kind of unusual because they debated this in this conference room, and I was right next door in another room listening on a closed radio circuit as they debated my fitness for about 2 days. And finally, it was in the middle of the night that the British and Irish governments decided that they'd had enough of it. So they came in and asked me, they said, we're going in. It sounded to me like an invasion of a foreign land. But I walked into the room. It was really pandemonium. two of the parties that were opposed were standing on their feet shouting, no, 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 no. And when I got seated, they walked out in protest. So it was not an auspicious beginning. But I got the meeting going, and then I called the two leaders up and invited them to come back the same day, the next morning, the same morning at about 11 o'clock. Everybody went home and slept for a few hours. And they ultimately did come back. And at the end, Dr. Paisley and I are now quite good friends. Whenever I go to Northern Ireland, I call or see him. We've had a lot of friendly chats about the past, and things have worked out very well.
What negotiating skills did you feel you were bringing to the table in the midst of all this?
Well, I didn't think I had any particular special skill or training. I suppose that the most effective bit of training was to have served as 6 years as a majority leader of the United States Senate. That's a pretty tough job. In fact, that's the toughest job I've ever had. You got a lot of people who are tough to deal with, and you don't have any power or authority of any kind. The position of majority leader is not mentioned in the Constitution, nor is it in any statute. It arose by custom in the 19th century, and as a result, there are no clearly defined powers. So I joke and say that all the majority leader can do is ask senators to do what they should be doing without being asked. But that was pretty good training for bringing people along. But, of course, the Senate didn't have the overlay of violence that existed in Northern Ireland. That was made it a very daunting task. There was quite a lot of violence when I was there. A lot of people killed, a lot of bombings. And it made it very, very difficult to get the parties together and to move it along. But as I said, after several years, they did so, and it's worked out pretty well so far.
It was said that you did a very important thing simply by listening for hours to Belfast politicians. So how did you get the two sides to finally trust each other?
I don't think they ever did trust each other. I think trust would be an overstatement. I think they came to accept that there were other interests than their own, and that the only way they could achieve their objective is to accommodate the other side to some extent. It's still a segregated society. We shouldn't exaggerate what has happened. It's been very good. The level of violence is way down, but there remain difficulties and issues. It will take quite a long time, I think a couple of generations, before you have genuine reconciliation that does involve trust. But I did listen a lot. On the first day, I said several things, some of which I later regretted. One of which is I said to them, look, I'm a product of the U.S. Senate. We have the rule of unlimited debate. I've listened to 16-hour speeches. I can listen to anything you guys have to say. And what I tried to do was to assure them that everybody would be heard, that nobody would be deprived of the opportunity to make their case. Well, I then spent 2 years listening, literally 2 years. That's a very long time to listen to the same people making the same arguments. But I said to them, you guys, some of you got a lot of criticism on me. One thing you will never be able to say is that you didn't have a chance to make your case. And as a result, I think I earned over time their trust and their confidence, and even those who opposed me later praised me and said, well, I was fair, I was independent, and I gave everybody a chance to be heard. So listening and being patient and being determined, not taking no for an answer, not the first no, not the 10th no, not the 100th no, you have to stick at it if you believe in the cause. And I believed that the cause of peace in Northern Ireland was worth the effort.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Senator George Mitchell, former U.S. Special Envoy for Northern Ireland. Our number, 412-246-2002, for your calls, questions, and comments. Let's go to Jim in Pleasant Hills. Jim, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. And Senator Mitchell, I want to thank you profusely for all of the Irish Americans, especially. It was a big sacrifice. But my question, and I'll get off, is that both you and Mr. Rooney talk about getting the two sides, the nationalists and the loyalists, together. And all of that is very good work. But where do you interact with the British government because they're the big dog in the kennel. They're the ones that have all the power. And yet almost all discussions concerning the North say, well, there's these two factions and, you know, they don't like each other, blah, blah, blah. But where does it come to where 40% of the people are employed by the British government? Where does that responsibility of theirs come down? You went over there and did a fantastic job. Why couldn't they have done that same thing in 1984? Thank you.
Well, of course, Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, one of the four constituent elements of the United Kingdom, the others being Scotland, Wales, and England, and therefore has legal and moral responsibility for governance there. What the Good Friday Agreement did was to gain agreement from all sides of the communities on many elements, including that the only way that the current status of Northern Ireland could be changed, that is, it being part of the United Kingdom, to become part of United Ireland, was through the vote of the people of Northern Ireland. Only they can decide that in a free and open referendum. Unless and until that occurs, it will remain part of the United Kingdom, and the British government will have legal responsibility there, just in the same way that it's not identical, but Pennsylvania's one of 50 states in the Union, and the American government has some responsibilities there as well. The government in Britain was seen by the Catholic population initially as its protector. When the violence broke out in the late 1960s and early 70s, the Catholic population of Northern Ireland felt that it was being physically oppressed and attacked, and they welcomed the presence of British troops to restore order. And then, of course, that changed over time, and they wanted the British troops out. And the Unionists, on the other hand, opposed the British government's entry at the outset, but then supported their staying. It was a reversal of positions caused by and related to the conflict. The government did try to get negotiations underway on several previous occasions. They actually did have negotiations in 1990 and 1991, but they failed for a whole variety of reasons. Primarily, they didn't include those who were engaged in the conflict. They limited the negotiations to what they called the constitutional parties, that is, the parties that weren't affiliated with paramilitary organizations on either side. And in retrospect, it's pretty obvious that it's tough to end a conflict if you exclude from the negotiations the people who are engaged in the conflict. We were able to get them in. That's the first thing I did for the governments, to get all of the parties in there, although that was very difficult. We never really had a what you call a full quorum at any time. So there is a responsibility that they have. They were very supportive of my effort, although I was completely independent of both governments.
What kind of dark moments did you live through before the Good Friday Agreement was finally won?
Every day. Literally every day. It was a very, very difficult process. Deeply discouraging, with a tremendous amount of repetition, acrimony, yelling back and forth, arguments, disputes, a pretty good level of, not good, I mean a pretty bad level, a relatively high level of ongoing violence, even though they had entered into ceasefires in 1994. They were routinely broken on both sides, and we spent a lot of time in the negotiations, one side demanding the expulsion of the other side demanding the expulsion of this side. Parties were expelled from the negotiations, parties returned to the negotiation, people walked out of the negotiations, people came back in. It was by far the toughest thing I've ever done in my life, and as I said, it lasted for 5 years, and so it was a very long time. And at one point, I was deeply discouraged and thought about leaving. I described that in my book, but I decided to stick it out, and I'm glad I did.
And what would you say was the most difficult obstacle to overcome in all of this? As these negotiations were dragging on for 5 years, what was the key sticking points in all of this?
There was no one key. There were a sequence of them. As soon as you solved one, another one came up. For example, the initial problem with getting into the negotiations was that the British government and the Unionist parties had insisted that the IRA disarm, completely disarm, before its political wing, the political party Sinn Féin, could enter the talks. And it proved to be an insurmountable obstacle. They asked me, as chairman of a small group with joined by two other colleagues, the former Prime Minister of Finland and the former chief of the Canadian military, to talk to people and figure a way out around it. Well, we did, and we made a report in January of 1996 that served as the basis for the negotiations, which is why they then came back to me and said, well, will you come chair the negotiations? We've got into it because of your report. Once that obstacle was solved, you had immediately other ones coming up. So there really were many. If you get to the root of it, it was mistrust. Neither side trusted the other. Neither side believed anything the other side had said. And each side had only its own version of their history. I'll illustrate with an anecdote. When President Clinton first came to Northern Ireland, I arranged meetings for him with the leaders of the parties, and I went with him. The first meeting was with Dr. Paisley, to whom you referred earlier, a unionist leader. He came in. The president was really tired. He had a long trip. It was late. I'd been with him. I was tired. Fortunately, we didn't have to say anything other than hello. Paisley then launched into a 30-minute history of Northern Ireland as seen through the eyes of the Protestant majority. And it was essentially a litany of everything that had been done wrong to them. A very powerful speaker, very emotional delivery. He left. Next was Gerry Adams, the head of Sinn Féin, the opposite of Dr. Paisley, I guess you'd call him, the counterpart on the Catholic or nationalist side. We said hello. He gave a 30-minute statement of the history of Northern Ireland as seen through the eyes of a Catholic leader, and they were completely diametrically opposite of what Paisley had just said. Both described what had been done wrong to their people. Neither acknowledged a single incident or event that was perpetrated on the other side. And you could see the vast gulf between them in what their understanding of their history was and what their complete level of mistrust was. That's the biggest problem. And that's why it took so long to get them to actually listen to the other side. And I think if I did anything, it was by demonstrating myself that I would listen to everybody. I got them finally into a mode where they didn't agree with, but they at least listened to and acknowledged that there were some things that the other side said that had merit.
Describe that last day leading up to the votes.
Oh, that was very tough. We had a tough time. I'll take it back a few more minutes, a few more months. On December 27th of 1997, a prominent Protestant paramilitary leader was assassinated while in prison by a group of Catholic prisoners. That touched off a retaliatory round of killings back and forth, back and forth. The British and Irish governments had scheduled discussions in January in London and in February in Dublin in the hopes that a change of scenery might change minds, but they didn't. The meetings were very acrimonious and didn't focus on the issues, but rather focused on expelling parties who were affiliated with the groups that were doing the killings on both sides. I flew from Dublin to New York. I think it was about February 15th or so, the middle of February, and I was deeply, deeply discouraged. And I felt this process is doomed. And I thought the only way to save it is to get them to agree to an absolute hard deadline. No breaking a deadline where we'd either succeed or fail. Otherwise, it would just dribble on, the deaths would continue. And I knew the history of Ireland, so I picked Easter weekend. And I set the original deadline at Thursday midnight because I knew I'd need a little leeway. I wrote up a plan on the airplane, and I came back. It took me about a month to sell it to all of them. But they agreed. And the last 2 weeks were extremely intense, difficult negotiations. The last few days, last couple of days, were round the clock, 24 hours, day and night, nonstop, going. And I knew we had a chance when they agreed to the deadline. And when I presented the final plan on the last morning, Friday, April 10th. I then spent the day, everybody's tired, the party's all caucused, and they started coming in. Yes, 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 yes. The only party left was the Ulster Unionist Party, the largest and most important Unionist Party. And under the rules, they had a veto power, as did the largest Catholic or Nationalist Party. And it wasn't until 4:45 that the leader of the party called me and told me they agreed to go ahead. I said, look, one thing I learned in the Senate is when you get the votes, you vote. So I said, I'm calling a meeting for 5 o'clock. He said, okay. So literally minutes later, hastily assembled, the delegates come in. They all agreed. The peace was established.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is Senator George Mitchell, former U.S. Special Envoy for Northern Ireland. I know we're running a little long on time, but I wanted to get to an email from Chris in Moon, who writes, I'm interested in what these retired paramilitaries are doing now. At the end of the conflict, some allegedly robbed banks with an eye to sinking the money into the housing market in Eastern Europe following the decline of the Soviet Union as a kind of pension fund. Gerry Adams went into diplomacy, but what about paras on active service? Is there a chance of them coming back as economic woes continue?
That's the first I've ever heard these allegations about Eastern Europe. I don't know anything about that. The fact is that a good many of them have become deeply engaged in the process and in encouraging peaceful resolution. If you go to Belfast now, there is a small but thriving industry of what they call the taxi tours, and they run on each side of the so-called peace line. The peace line is a large wall built that divides the two populations. It goes right through the middle of the city. It's quite a sight. It's actually ugly and difficult, but necessary still. And a former IRA leader is one of the drivers who takes tourists on a tour of the Nationalist or Republican or Catholic side of the wall, and then they turn you over to a former Protestant paramilitary leader. There's a gate between the two at one point that you can pass through, and they take you for a tour on their side of the wall. And they are now, they tell the story, and tourists from all over the world. I was there a few months ago with my family, and of course they've got this wall. Everybody's invited to sign it. It's a huge thing where you go and sign your name, and there were people there from China, from Africa, from Europe, tourists all over the world come to see the wall and to be told the stories by these former paramilitaries. Now, I'm sure that not all of them are doing the right thing, like any group of humans anywhere, but by and large, they've been substantial contributors to the effort to move forward. And in the negotiations, a couple of leaders emerged on the paramilitary side, on the Protestants, who are outstanding in keeping the process moving forward at very difficult times. So these are men, primarily men, but some women, who committed grievous acts. They thought they were doing it in a patriotic cause. The opposition thought of them as criminals and murderers. Many of them have now become outspoken advocates for peace.
What can the world learn from the Good Friday Agreement?
That there's no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are conducted by humans. They're started and they're extended by humans. They can be ended by humans. Indeed, they all end one way or the other. Either you get a complete victory by one side and a defeat of the other, or they reach some kind of accommodation. And I think that will happen in the Middle East. It's happened in a lot of places. It happened in South Africa. It happened in Northern Ireland. It happened in a lot of other places. It happened more than I can describe. described now, and I think it'll happen in the Middle East, because in the end, people act on their self-interest. History tells us that it sometimes takes a long time for individuals and for societies and for nations to discern what their true self-interest is. I think that the people of Northern Ireland figured out that whatever their self-interest was, it did not include killing each other over disagreements that could be resolved by democratic and peaceful means. And as I said, it remains a segregated society, but they are a productive, energetic, very, very strong people. And I think they set an example for others as to what can be done. No two conflicts are the same. Indeed, no two people are the same. So you can't take a formula from one and apply it to another. But you can look and see, here they did this. They were killing each other for a long time. Some date their conflict back 800 years to the beginning of the British domination of Ireland. And they finally reached agreement. And secondly, what you can take from it is fashionable, common in all societies, including our own, for the public to ridicule, to demean, to think very poorly of their elected officials. And there's reason for that in most cases. In Northern Ireland, a group of political leaders, ordinary men and women, just like you and I and people listening on the phone, who had spent their lives in conflict, many of whom had killed others, some of whom had been shot and shot at, came together and in a moment of courage reached agreement for the betterment of their country, even at enormous risk to themselves, their lives, and their careers. And so it demonstrates that courageous political leadership is possible in every society. You can't identify who the people are who will do it in other places, but you know it exists because you saw it happen there.
I wanted to reference a Twitter question from Nicole, who asked about recent tensions, i.e., a thwarted bombing attempt in Northern Ireland at the beginning of March. What are your concerns about that?
Well, they're serious concerns, but let's be clear. Every society has problems. Every society has violence, including our own, subject of much debate now, including the United Kingdom, including the Republic of Ireland, including every country that ever has or ever was. We ought not to establish for Northern Ireland a standard that's higher than the standard that applies anywhere else in the world. There are real problems, and we have to be diligent and concerned about them, because there are fringe elements, small numbers, but nonetheless able to do much damage on both sides, who are not reconciled to the process, who want their way 100%, and who regard any compromise as a sign of weakness, of surrender, of the lack of conviction. They're wrong, and their tactics are wrong, and they must be condemned and pursued and prosecuted when they commit crimes. But let's remember that the nation, that the Northern Ireland, is at peace. Let's emphasize the important things. We need to help create jobs, investment, so that people will be working and less likely to succumb to the advocates of terror. And overall, if you go there and see it, it's a tremendously vibrant place. These are terrific people. I acknowledge I'm biased. I spent 5 years there, and I've gone back regularly ever since. I really love Northern Ireland, and I like the people there, but they've made a tremendous advance, although it is imperfect, as are all human efforts. There will continue to be problems there, just as there are going to be problems here and elsewhere.
Our guest has been United States Special Envoy for Northern Ireland, George Mitchell, a former U.S. Senator from Maine who had served as Senate Majority Leader. And Senator Mitchell has been named the inaugural recipient of the La Roche College Peace Medal in recognition of his work. The award will be presented tomorrow. And Senator Mitchell will also be the keynote speaker for the 8th Annual Global Problems Global Solutions Conference. The session at the Duquesne Club that will include his remarks starts at 6 p.m. tomorrow night. Senator Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, travel correspondent Elaine LaBalme discovers Columbus when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.